So good to be with you. The writer of Mark's Gospel doesn't psychologize. It's a very straightforward account of Jesus' ministry, bare bones, if you will, that starts at his baptism. And so we see that scenario kind of at play in our text today. Jesus acts. People in his hometown react. Then Jesus moves on. And the people in Nazareth are left with their hearts on their sleeves, wondering at their reaction. And the question, now what, seems to linger in the air. It's like when you connect with an old friend or a long-lost relative, and you have certain memories of what that was like the last time you were together, and you say with an open heart, well, come on over. And then they come over, and then things don't go as you hoped they would. The conversation unfolds differently than you thought it would. And by the end of the evening, you're inwardly begging them to leave, even as you keep smiling. I mean, the townspeople, they had good memories of Jesus. And like all of us, they don't want those memories disturbed. They thought it was their thoughts about him that counted. Local boy, we hear he's making a name for himself. Good for him. I mean, he always had great hands. He was like his pa. He could make anything. Good laborer. He's a good man, but he's no scholar. Ah, let's go hear what he has to say. It will amuse us. But then what he says flabbergasts them. He speaks with such authority, and it hits them. Wait a second. This is what he's been doing out there. This is what he's been saying out and about. I mean, we know you. We know what street you grew up on. They have to reckon now with something that's deeply uncomfortable for them. God's presence in and through this person they knew as he grew up among them. And that threatens them. It means they have less control than they think they do. What they seem to take offense at is his growth and the implicit judgment on their lack of growth. It's their need for comfort and security that is exposed by Jesus' connection to something that to them feels unsafe. Now, it's not a bad thing to ask questions when our comfortable beliefs are challenged. It's usually helpful, actually, to put the onus on the new belief to prove itself in the marketplace of ideas. Think about Mary's question to Gabriel at the Annunciation. How can this be, since I've not known a man? I mean, it's a fair question. Think about the disciples' own fright and awe-filled question when, I think we read this story a couple of weeks ago, when Jesus stilled the storm. Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? But listen to the difference to these two phrasings. How can this be, since I have not known a man? How can this be, since I've not known a man? Our text today seems to suggest that the people didn't ask the question, when did this man get all this, like that? They asked it like, when did this man get all this? What wisdom is this? The first way of reading reveals people that really want to know. The second way reveals people that don't want to know. Now let that sink in. We can ask questions and want to know, and we can ask questions, but we don't want to know. There you have a big part of the human conundrum. We say we want to know, we say we want to listen, but often we don't. Often we just want bread and circuses. We really just want to be amused, to find comfort. I get it. I do too. How can Christianity be relevant today? We ask. Or we can ask, how could Christianity be relevant today? Kind of like a joke. Our scorn protecting us from what might yet be revealed. To truly want to know is, for those of you who get this reference, to take the red pill, to open ourselves to that which might be uncomfortable and perhaps profoundly, at least on one level, psychologically unsafe. To ask it the second way is to take, of course, the blue pill, to want to stay where we're at, to not be bothered too much. I always think in the context of these sorts of discussions of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and that little exchange between Susan and Mr. Beaver. Aslan is a lion, the great lion. "Oh," said Susan, "I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion." "Safe?" said Mr. Beaver. "Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. Of course he isn't safe. But he's good." When I taught theology to undergraduates, and truth be told, every time I preach, there's always a subtext in the form of a question. And it's first of all directed to me. Do I really want to learn what I'm reading? And then, of course, I'm asking you, do you really want to know? Because knowing something new, in the way the Bible understands knowing, will cost me, will cost you something. We don't learn in a vacuum. Truly learning something changes us. Knowing that, do you still want to know? The healing path of Christ can paradoxically create fissures in families as we come to understand dysfunctional behavior. Deeper knowledge can lead those who were once friends to separate. What we see happen time and time again in the Gospels actually still happens. I mean, I could tell you about three conversations I had this week that were in this mode. People approaching the truth and then having to ask a difficult question. Do I want to continue? Because that means I probably won't have much of a relationship over here anymore. I wonder why that happens. And I think one of the reasons is that taking offense, at least initially, is the easier approach. It feels just simpler to say, no, I'm not going there. It's what we do when we want to protect ourselves from the scary call to transformation. Now, I kind of hesitated to do this this morning, but it just seemed like I needed to because it just fit too closely. I don't try to unnecessarily share my own spiritual journey. In fact, the great biblical scholar Christer Stendahl of Harvard fame used to always say, "None of your little stories." for sermons. He's very clear about that. His 10 rules of biblical preaching, none of your little stories. But he said, you know, of course, they're once or twice in your ministry, you can do this sort of thing. And I want you to know that I'm really not the hero of what I'm about to say next. Mostly just confused. Really confused through the process, but competitive and stubborn enough to continue. So it was 2010, and I was, as Anglican priests do at General Synod gatherings, this one in Halifax, we were drinking whiskeys together late at night. And one of the guys was the executive archdeacon in the Diocese of New West, and he said, hey, you should come and restart St. Matthew in Abbotsford, because it and two other churches have taken the Diocese of New Westminster and the Anglican Church of Canada to court over wanting to take their respective buildings with them as they exit the Anglican Church of Canada. And all of this, of course, was over the diocesan decision to bless same-sex unions for those Christians who wanted to commit to a monogamous long-term relationship. So back in Moose Jaw, Denise and I are discerning this call, and I'm like all for it, and she's all for it, and my spiritual director is all for it. But underneath the surface, there's a little bit of hubris, right? Like, how hard could that be? How hard could that be? People will flock to it since they're sick of this reactionary stuff that's been going on there for decades. Now, I'm certainly no prophet, but you would have thought I was given the hometown welcome I received. And yes, I grew up in the Mennonite community there. So what follows next is just going to sound crazy, but it all happened exactly this way. I'm at a farewell party at a parishioner's house in Moose Jaw, and somebody hand delivers a large packet into the backyard where we're all sitting around chatting about our time of ministry together in the years in Moose Jaw. And I open the letters, or this packet, and it's a bunch of letters from Abbotsford, all of them which proclaim my impending doom. People wishing me dead say I'm going to develop large, obscene-looking cancers all over my body. And then when we get to Abbotsford, we have to hire security at the church because it's regularly vandalized with obscene graffiti. And everything I try fails miserably. I arrange a conference with my brother, who at that time regularly draws several thousand people to his concerts, especially if they're held in Abbotsford. I team him, not with myself, because I'm not that stupid, with an inspirational best-selling author, and we start promoting this conference, and we sell, wait for it, 8 tickets, 4 of which I think were from my family. I go to a clergy lunch that includes all of the pastors in town, and I'm literally heckled into leaving the meeting with catcalls. You're a wimp! Following me out the door. So those were just the conservatives. On the other side were the sociopathic liberals, who upon discovering that I believed in the living, resurrected Christ, began to write the bishop, telling her that I was corrupt, that I was sleeping with my secretary, and stealing money from the church, and working 3 hours a month. So I developed a heart condition. I gained weight. I stopped praying, which is not a good thing to do, and wondering, what the heck am I doing here? But here's the amazing thing. Change is possible. God's grace makes it possible. God's grace requires our consent, and we can shut it down in offense, Or we can say, yes, teach me. I want to learn. If some people shut it out, others will open to it, which is always one of the great miracles of humanity, but also of God's relationship with humanity. So I'm so grateful for that. A few people begin to ask questions in Abbotsford about a dynamic middle way. Do we always have to go to extremes on everything? What does real inclusive church look like? People who have been asked to leave their churches because of their beliefs, or in some cases even their sexual orientation, some of them on the brink of suicide, begin to make their way to our little fellowship. And families who want to teach their children that truth, wherever we find it, is compatible with a deep Christian faith, well, they begin to come as well. So people deconstructing or reconstructing their faith, just ordinary people, from the chief prosecutor to a couple of homeless folk, and they all find this place welcoming, and they find a path. And it's really the collection of folks who make the song beautiful, right? They're singing the harmony. My part, simply, very simple, just to expose God's beauty, truth, and goodness in these wild and wacky stories in our Bible and in our world, in history, in literature, and in the process of growth itself. And then fail a lot doing that, and then rinse and repeat. I mean, is it any accident that right after Jesus' experience in his old hometown, he sends out his followers to experience the scary and exhilarating presence of God in their interactions with people? And in the resulting scary and exhilarating process of growth for themselves. Growth into God is always that way. It can be profoundly uncomfortable. It can be deeply challenging, requiring us to develop the fruit of the Spirit. It will challenge the status quo of your life and your relationships profoundly. But having said all of that, I really only have one wish for you that comes forcefully to me out of this text this morning. That when you say you want to learn, you truly do. For when you do, then the game is afoot. Amen.